Well, good afternoon, and it is a Juneau afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today. We'll be talking with Lenny Kamerling, who is the curator of the film collection up at the Museum of the North in Fairbanks, about a new program series that's going to start on 360 North. Barb Anjak will be here from NEA Alaska to talk about the state's largest union. Caroline Schultz will come in and talk to us about the LunaFest Film Festival, which will be here in Juneau next week. And we'll discuss the choice that 8th graders are going to be making about the high school they'll be attending next year with folks from the Juneau School District. Weather today is for sunny, the highs 0 to 6 above 0. East winds 15 to 25 miles per hour. They'll shift to the north in the afternoon. Wind chill to 25 below 0 in exposed locations.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The leader of the Muscogee Creek Nation says a branch of the tribe seeking to build a casino in Oklahoma has failed to follow proper procedures to allow for gaming on the site. But as KGOU's Kurt Gwartney reports, the builders of the casino say the chief is now playing politics.
At a news conference Monday, Chief George Tiger said the Muscogee Creek Nation has not yet received an application from the Kailigi tribal town for a Bureau of Indian Affairs business lease or a request to conduct gaming operations. Ground has already been broken on the land for the casino near Tulsa, Oklahoma, owned by two sisters who are trying to transfer their allotment to the tribe. Tiger says the land should not be used as the site of a tribal casino by any other tribe or tribal town without the consent of the Creek Nation. The National Indian Gaming Commission has also not granted approval for the Kailigi's gambling project. A statement from the Kailigi tribal town released Monday said Tiger was opposing the casino on political grounds, but the tribe of about 300 members says it hopes the disagreement can be settled through intertribal discussions. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney.
Navajo Nation President Ben Shelley says the tribe's newest casino is a step toward self-sufficiency, pointing to the nearly 400 jobs created by the business venture. The Northern Edge Casino, the third owned by the tribe, opened Monday near Farmington, New Mexico. The 86,000-square-foot facility includes slot machines, poker tables, and food service. A Western Canadian First Nation has taken action against gangs that have disrupted and terrorized their community for years. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, three teenage boys have been charged in the shooting last summer that claimed the life of a 5-year-old boy.
Ethan Yellowbird was asleep in his bed when he was struck in the head by a bullet that was fired outside his home on the Samson Cree Reserve about 60 miles south of Edmonton. It was also the second shooting that day. The Samson First Nation has been struggling with gang violence for years. About a dozen gangs have been fighting over the drug trade on the reserve. Police say they have been faced with the fact that in the past people in the community have been afraid to come forward. But Elder John Cryer says Ethan Yellowbird's death marked a turning point.
I live here. I know these people. I know the young families. But, you know, there are more people who are determined, you know, to find a way than there are people who are, you know, who have fear.
Meanwhile, the chief, Marvin Yellowbird, who is also the grandfather of the victim, says he hopes more members of the reserve will keep talking with police so more arrests can be made in many other unsolved crimes. 5-year-old Ethan was not the only child to be caught up in the violence. In 2008, 2-year-old Asia Saddleback was shot as she sat at a kitchen table eating dinner. She survived, but the bullet is permanently lodged between her liver and her spine. It appears now that more people are determined to find a way to help end the gang violence. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
An Aboriginal woman in Canada makes history, becoming a Supreme Court justice in the Northwest Territories. Shannon Smallwood is reportedly the first Aboriginal woman to hold the position. Smallwood was sworn in Friday in Yellowknife. She was born in the territory and followed her mother's encouragement to become anything she wanted. She received her education in Calgary, studying criminal law. People in the community see her as a role model. And others hope having a northern-born judge will help create a stronger link with communities in the territory. During this week in 1974, according to a report from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Menominee tribe officially resumed receiving federal services. The tribe's federal recognition status had been terminated more than a decade earlier. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
Every Alaskan can support causes and organizations they care about when they file for a permanent fund dividend. Use PIC, CLIC, GIVE when filing online for your PFD. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
Support for National Native News comes from the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 5 minutes after 3 in the afternoon. To continue that weather forecast we were talking about just before National Native News started, tonight's weather forecast is going to be for clear, with the lows continuing to be below zero. Tonight's forecast is for it to go down to 10 below zero. We'll have north winds 15 to 25 miles per hour. And with the wind chill, that brings it to 25 below zero in the exposed locations. So if you happen to be out this evening for some reason, bundle up well. And if you need to turn on one of the faucets in the house to keep the plumbing from freezing up, this would be a really good night to do it. Well, you're in tune with KTOO News. You have Juno Afternoon, and my first guest is actually not here in the studio with me. However, he is in Fairbanks, Alaska, sitting at, I think, the museum. Is that where your offices are, Lenny?
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Our guest is Len Kamerling, who has had a long history of being an incredible cinematographer in the state of Alaska, and is now in charge of curating a collection of Alaskan films at the Museum of the North. Is that the name of the museum?
Yes, the Alaska Museum of the North, right?
You're right. Okay, and I have to tell you that Lenny and I worked together in 72 and 73, I think it was, Lenny, when we were both at KUAC together,
a long time ago.
Yeah, and I had a disparate career, but you stayed with it and have made yourself famous with film. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
So we're going to do a series of films on 360 North, which the TV system that runs around the state. And this series of films, I think, has some really unique content. You're kicking it off with one which has made it to the National Film Register.
That's right. Yes, The Drums of Winter.
And tell us a little bit about The Drums of Winter.
Well, The Drums of Winter is a film about Yupik music and dance and the potlatching, the gift-giving exchange tradition. And one of the unique things about this film, about this entire series that's going to be shown, is that all of these films are the product of long collaborations with the communities in which they were made. So in the early 70s, myself and my filmmaking partner at the time, Sarah Elder, we had this idea about a kind of shared authorship, what people today call a kind of a shared anthropology, that what goes into the film shouldn't be the vision of someone from the outside, but it should be a process of trying to agree on an idea about representation and an idea about the truth of a place, and allowing that to come forward over a long period of time through the back and forth of collaboration. The Drums of Winter is very much a part of that, and because I think that we were engaged in this kind of risky way of making films. So many doors open to us, doors that we never would have seen had we been on any other path. When we started that film, we knew we wanted to treat Yupik dance tradition in some way, but we had no idea where the film was going to go. And the film we ended up with was not the film we thought we were making in the beginning. It turned into so much more than we ever expected it was and it would be, and that's really because of this long process of collaboration.
When you say long process, for the Drums of Winter, you were involved in its production, right?
Yes, I am the co-director, co-producer director.
So how long was the period in which you were collaborating with the native elders, native villagers, in order to come up with the way in which the film was going to take shape?
Initially, we collaborated with a group of elders and dancers to just talk about where to start, where to go forward. And so often in films like this, which are not scripted, which don't have a scenario, that's the essential thing, is moving it forward, getting the process moving forward. And then as ours and the people in the villages, as our understanding of what we were doing, of this process deepened, then we start to see other windows, other doors, and the story starts to take shape and dissolve. Drums of Winter took us almost 10 years to make, and our initial filming, we were there for a period of about 4 months, and we edited and for a couple of years, and because of financial concerns, we left it to raise more money. But then we realized that we had to go back and find additional material. I guess what I'm saying is that as we learned more about Yupik dance traditions, the more we learned that it's really about everything. And so we had to go into areas that we didn't even know existed before. But it was a very exciting process, one of real, very exhilarating kind of creativity, even though it took such a long time. It's really a handmade film that evolved slowly over a long period of time, and I think the fact that it's had such a long life, and it's had the recognition that it has had, and it's still a work that's still alive in Yupik communities, it validates the time that we took and the effort that we put in to spend all those years to really get it right.
If I were interviewing one of the elders that had worked on the film with you, do you think he'd be telling me the same things?
That's a great question. Perhaps. I think one of the things that convinced the elders and the people in the village to work with us to make this film was the idea of having something for their children and their grandchildren and for generations unborn to see that would be true. And that idea of what's true in film is something that filmmakers love to stay up all night arguing about, or whether they're kind of documentary.
Certainly true.
But I think we all understand that. We all agree that what you see in a film is—it's not the truth. It's edited. It's, you know, what you don't show is often as important as what you do show. But we agree that it did represent a kind of truth, and one that the people in the village felt that they could look at it and say, "Yes, that's our place. That's us." I think it has been very effective in keeping that kind of vision and that history alive.
So this film is going to be accessible to people who watch 360 North tomorrow night at 8 p.m. And then the films are each going to repeat on the following Sunday at 7 in the evening. So tomorrow night at 8 is right after the governor has the State of State address. We should have a remarkably large audience for the possibility of the Drums of Winter. After that, then you're doing From the First People for the second film in the series, and that's on the 25th of January. Can you tell us a bit about that one?
From the First People takes place in the Kobuk River village of Shumnak. And it was made before the Drums of Winter. And our initial idea was to make one collaborative film in each different language area of Alaska, native language area. And that never quite happened. Real life intervened. But we did make a film in Yupik language film there, and again we had no idea what it was going to be about when we began. But what emerged was a story of change, of people who live on a river who are tied, whose lives are tied to seasonal change into the river, into the subsistence realms, and that kind of contrasts what an ancient Inupiaq prophet predicted for people in the future, measured against the reality of what was really happening there. So it's a film very much about change.
So over the next, I think we do 6 of these, is that right? There's a total of 6 films. So this will be 6 Wednesdays in a row. And then if Wednesday doesn't work out for folks, it'll be repeated on Sunday evenings. So it's possible to see the films, to have 2 opportunities to see the films. Is there anything planned? This is almost like a mini course in the cinematography of the Arctic, I guess, something like that. Is anything planned to formalize people's viewing of this at all?
I don't think so, but I think people will find that there is a real kind of continuity of a kind of style and knowledge between the films, and that if they watch all of them, they'll see our kind of developing style and developing maturity as filmmakers as we made one more film after another, how our our approach our approach became more sophisticated, and I think each film goes a little deeper and is a little more complex and is a little more challenging for the audience. And so I'm so excited that the films are going to be shown on 360 and people are going to have a chance to see them all in a row. But I think the course will invite people to kind of think about change, think about how film works as a conveyor of history and this elusive kind of documentary truth. And I hope kind of invite people to reflect on life in Alaska and how our state has changed over these years.
Well, I think it's a wonderful opportunity to see some truly unique films, much of the material I think that you're going to be airing is just not readily available. I think people may have access here to film footage that just is not going to be seen any other way.
That's right. And these films could not be made today. Most of the films were made in the 70s and 80s. Most of the elders represented in the films are now gone. And so the films really are in a very large way kind of a magic window into the past. And it really lets us see a time that's, that was, I think, very particular. So I guess if I had to define the films as a series, I'd say that their intention is not to teach people about Alaska or Native culture, but rather the intention of the films is kind of to create a mood, to create a kind of a sense of intimacy about these places and about the time that it was filmed in.
What a wonderful phrase, a magic window. That's, I think, what all film and visual media really are, is they are magic windows into the world.
It really is. And, I recently looked at some films, some of the first films that were ever made in 1895, and it just, they are that. It's like this moment of privilege to be able to look past into that window. And I hope people look at these films in that same way. What? I think in that Native villages where they will see these films, many people will recognize and, I think have strong feelings about the time. And also, and a way of life which has, were transformed since then, and also many of the people who were not around anymore.
Well, Lenny, thank you for three things. Thank you for having been the person who probably was the force behind the making of these films. Thank you also for what had to have been a lot of work to assemble this package like this. And thank you very much for talking with us today about the upcoming showing of these six films on 360 North, Wednesday nights at 8 p.m., repeating Sunday nights at 7 p.m. Lenny, good luck in the rest of your career as the curator of the Alaska Center for Documentary Film at the University of Alaska Museum of the North.
Thank you, and thank you so much for making this series possible.
Yeah, it's wonderful talking with you after, 35, 40 years of...
Yes, well, hopefully it won't be so long next time.
Yeah, I hope so. Bye.
This is Bird Note. A cry of the kittiwake rings out across the Northern Ocean. Kittiwakes were well known to even the earliest northern seafarers. Named for its rhythmic calls, the black-legged kittiwake, as it's known in North America, is a dapper oceanic gull. The tips of its pale gray wings look as though they've been dipped in black ink. Unlike many gulls, kittiwakes spend most of the year at sea and are seldom seen inland. Vast numbers live on the Bering Sea, where they are by far the most abundant gull. Ornithologist Arthur Bent wrote of nesting kittiwakes, "This species is always associated in my mind, in its summer home, with the dark, frowning cliffs of the frozen north, which tower for hundreds of feet above the stormy, ice-bound seas, until lost to sight in shrouds of mist and fog. A safe retreat in which to raise their hardy offspring." In winter, black-legged kittiwakes can be found along the west coast from southern Alaska to Baja California, and along the east coast from Labrador to Florida. Thank you for listening to Bird Note on this station. We're also on the web at birdnote.org, where you can view the transcripts, find a library of past shows, see photos of all the birds, and sign up to receive the shows by podcast. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
It's 24 minutes after 3. You're in tune with KTO FM News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for a Juneau afternoon. It's going to get really cold tonight. We're talking about 10 below zero up to maybe zero in some of the sheltered areas with some wind blowing. So with the combination of that, it's going to have a chill factor around here of 25 degrees below zero, which I'm not sure that would even be mentioned on the radio in Fairbanks, but or maybe up in Anchorage where the wind blows when it gets cold like this. But for us, this is unusual weather. I don't know if anyone notices it, but we're almost 25 degrees below the normal temperature for the day. If you do go out this evening and you're wandering around in the wind, bundle up well and don't expose a lot of flesh, because those temperatures, interesting things can happen. Well, my next guest is Barbara Ngaiak, and Barbara is the president of the National Education Association-Alaska. So welcome, Barb.
Thank you.
You're the president of the biggest union in the state of Alaska.
Yes, I am.
How many members do you have?
We have a little bit over 13,000 statewide.
And who are these members?
These are school employees. They are teachers. They are education support professionals. In some districts, they're known as classified employees. They're paraprofessionals, teacher aides, secretaries, cooks, custodians, maintenance people, all the folks that are really crucial to keeping our schools open.
How many people are part of the union structure, the administration, your staff?
How many employees do we have?
Yeah.
That is, I think, 27.
Oh, okay. So 27 people for all of those thousands of that you're representing, all those thousands.
Correct.
To.
Correct.
And you are in charge of negotiations with how many school districts?
We have 67 local associations and close to that many contracts around the state. We do have some more broad contracts that have divisions within them because of the different categories of employees, but just about that many contracts.
Now, do you represent teachers as well?
We represent teachers and education
and
support professionals.
And support professionals. Are there different sets of contract negotiations? I would assume that those are two different pay sequences or something like
they
that.
They are, for the most part, they can be classified as salaried and hourly. So we do have different types of negotiations when we are bargaining for a salaried contract versus an hourly wage.
What are the duties of the president of the NEA? What's the nut of your job description?
Well,
Other than the person in charge of everything.
Well, it's kind of a little bit of everything, that's for sure. But primarily, my role is to be the sole spokesperson for the organization, which is important because if we have some people saying different things, that could be a problem. My role also is to be the primary decision maker with regard to what our policies are going to be and positions that we're going to take on things in between meetings of the board and meetings of our annual delegate assembly, where we have representative membership who come all together and set the course for the following year.
What's the relationship between the NEA national organization and NEA Alaska?
Every state and the group of employees that work in schools overseas that are part of our federal affiliate, there is one state affiliate in every state in the union, and the bigger national organization has about 3.2 million members nationally. And so we work very closely with the larger NEA, and we work in conjunction also with other state affiliates to make sure that we are sharing information with them and they with us.
To what extent does national policy by the NEA drive, is there any kind of hierarchical structure here? I guess is what I'm asking.
I understand the question. In the NEA, We are a very, very democratic organization. And each subdivision, each state affiliate, each local affiliate does have a certain amount of autonomy to make their own decisions. And it has been a long-standing practice for NEA Alaska to not necessarily always agree with the national. Sometimes we do, but we don't have any hesitation to let national know that we don't agree in some cases.
Why don't we agree? You know, what would be a typical area where there would be friction between... Oh, well, maybe it's not friction, but disagreement between national and state, Alaska.
An example that comes to mind that has happened in my years of being a member was a proposal that our national leaders had for us to form a merged organization with the American Federation of Teachers. And we felt in Alaska that we didn't subscribe to the ideas of AFT because we have a very representative type of arrangement. We have a one-person, one-vote type of governing structure, and they don't do that. They elect people to represent them, and those people are the ones who get the vote and not the individual members. And so the members of NEA Alaska who were at the national convention voted against the merger, and there were many folks in leadership positions at the national that didn't necessarily like or where we stood on it, but they accepted it because they know that we are so democratic in how we look at things, and that's what the members decided, was not to merge.
Are there AFT members in Alaska?
There are AFT members in Alaska. They are affiliated with APEA.
Oh, okay.
The Alaska Public Employees Association.
So does it happen that you have both of the unions working in some organizations?
We don't have any that are working in the same organization in Alaska. There are places in the country where mergers have taken place. Minnesota, Montana, Florida. I think there's one other state, but they have worked things out, and they like that arrangement of being a merged organization. We just felt it wasn't right for us in Alaska, and pretty much the other organization, the AFT, in Alaska, with the exception, I believe, of Valdez, I don't think they have any K-12 folks. They do have members of their organization in higher ed.
What are the big issues that the NEA will be addressing over this next year?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because they're big issues. Education funding is paramount for us. It's critical. We have a lot of money in this state right now, and we need to shore up our infrastructure and make sure that our schools are on sound footing for many years into the future, make sure that the funding is adequately taking care of the needs that we have, but also making sure that school districts have an amount of money that they can count on and can budget for, so that they're not worried about whether they are or are not going to have to pink slip employees, perhaps drop programs, not be able to do all of the things that our kids need them to do. So that is really critical. Another critical issue for us is the return to a defined benefit retirement for public employees. And that's not just school employees. That is public employees across the state. You may recall that in July of 2006, new employees in the public sector in Alaska were no longer included in a defined benefit. They had a 401k type plan. And since that time, we've had more and more employees come into that system, and it's problematic because these are people who do not pay into Social Security, and so they have no safety net in place to be able to really be sure that there's going to be income for them when they retire.
So these are the two key issues that you're addressing at this
point?
Those
are very, very important. two others that are very important to us are housing for public employees in rural communities where there are not housing units or apartments available in the community to be rented. So it's, and we really have broadened this out over the last several years to include all public employees who have a need for housing in those communities, not just teachers. We know primarily teachers are there for, you know, 9 or 10 months of the year, but there are also itinerant public workers who need housing when they go into those communities, such as public health nurses, state troopers who have to go in and do an investigation, OCS workers. All of those types of folks need some place to stay when they go into the community. So we're looking at how we can figure out a plan that would meet those needs, you know, because there are so many communities that just don't have anything available.
And you mentioned two secondary issues.
Right.
Then.
And the other one is we're looking this session to try to figure out how we can get equity for our education support professionals to make sure that they have the same type of system that teachers currently have, where when they retire, they get credit toward their retirement, the total amount of retirement credit that they get for their sick leave that they have not used. Teachers currently do get credit. If you have 100 days, let's say for an example, of sick leave days that you have not used over the life of your teaching career, when you retire, that is applied toward your retirement benefit. And it's a benefit to the employer, too, if employees are not using their sick leave, because it's much more beneficial to have the employee rather than a substitute mm-hmm. in the job. So our education support professionals are looking for equity. They currently do not get credit for their sick leave that they haven't used, and we think it's a fairness issue.
Barb, you've mentioned these four priorities that mm-hmm. are obviously, you're almost like a kind of a platform. So how will you go about trying to bring about change on those things? What actions do you take?
Well, we have quite a comprehensive lobbying program. We bring in members from across the state to come help with our lobbying effort in Juneau. We also have a legislative contact structure where our members can sign up to receive legislative updates, and within those updates, we have calls to action for phone calls, for emails, for letters to be written, kind of a comprehensive way of staying in touch with legislators. Our board meets in Juneau in the spring to make sure that we have a chance to have our whole board meet with legislators. And we have a consistent lobbying team. There are three of us. As the president, I'm the official spokesperson for the organization, but I can't be here the entire session nonstop. So we also have our government relations director, John Alcantara, who is here throughout the session. I think he goes home on the weekends, but he's here for the session, and if there are meetings happening on the weekends, he's here too. And our executive director is also a part of that team. And so we make sure that we have someone here all the time to make sure that, particularly when bills that are of concern to our members are being discussed, that we are there, we have a presence, we give testimony, we write numerous position papers and those kinds of things to make sure that our position and our opinions are heard by the people who are making the decisions.
Barb, do you like doing this?
you're laughing.
What a wonderful response.
Well,
are you sure?
You know, there was a time when that was the one aspect to this work that I thought I would never appreciate and never like, but I think I do like it.
Ah.
I mean, especially if I can say something or do something or provide some information that helps someone make an informed decision. I think it's really powerful and exciting.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Barb and Gayek, who is the president of the National Education Association Alaska, NEA Alaska, which is the largest union in the state of Alaska and represents a broad range of educational professionals and support personnel across the state. Barb, I wish you good luck with your upcoming lobbying efforts with the legislature toward moving money into education where it should be.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me. Pat Moore, your host for Juno Afternoon today. It's about 17 minutes before 4 o'clock. My next guest is going to tell us some details about a film festival. Today seems to be the film show. We talked with Len Kamerling earlier in the show about a series of films that's going to be on 360 North. However, there's a series of films which is going to show here in Centennial Hall. When does the show start?
It starts at 6 p.m. on Friday. Well, sorry, the silent auction starts at 6 p.m., and the film will start at 6:30.
My guest is Lisa Egan Lagerquist, and you're part of the organizing group that's putting this together, right?
Yes.
It's called the Luna Quest because it's actually put together, or Luna Fest, because it's actually put together by the people who make Luna Bars.
Correct.
They assemble the films, but the reason for putting it on in Juneau is...
So Luna Bar started Luna Fest, which is a film festival, so they have entries from all over, and they select the top films, and then they get played nationally to fundraise for breast cancer. Everywhere it's shown, $250 or 15% of the proceeds go to the breast cancer fund, and the rest goes to the local organization. and I'm part of the Juno Pro-Choice Coalition, so we're hosting this event for the sixth time in a row to raise money for the Breast Cancer Fund and for Juno Pro-Choice, and we are very excited about the films this year as every year.
What are the films?
So the films range from about 4 to 15 minutes long, and they're just so thought-provoking and such a wide variety of what you'll see. Some of them made me cry. Some of them made me laugh. And they all made me think. There's one about a group of Pacific Island women from East Palo Alto in California that make a rugby team.
A former rugby team, right.
Yes.
Yeah.
And how, mm-hmm. Have you heard of that one?
I have, yes.
And that I'm sort of an athlete, so that one really touched home for me. There's also one about an unmarried Persian woman going to her sister's wedding and what that's like being unmarried and going to a wedding where everyone wants you to get married also. There's one about a woman in Tehran who, because of an accident, doesn't have her headscarf and how that plays out for her. There's another one about a young boy who is sure she is a young girl and is how that plays. I would guess, they don't tell you in the film, I would guess she's around 10 or 11, but she has played her life as a woman, is planning to continue doing that. So as I said, they're just really thought-provoking and fascinating. And, oh, I forgot to say, they come from all over the world. There's one place in Africa, we said Tehran. So it's different than a lot of other things you see in Juno. It's a very unique experience.
These films were produced in Africa and Tehran. Is that right?
The one in Africa, the footage is definitely scenes in Africa. The one in Tehran, I think it is, although it may just be made to look like it.
Oh, okay. So they're not in the language. It's
they are. Some of them are subtitled.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
So how do you know how Luna selected this selection of short films?
I don't know exactly. I know they have a selecting committee and many people put in their films. So I'm not exactly sure what the criteria is. If
I think the single criterion is it must be made by a woman. Isn't that right?
They say they're by, for, and about women.
Yes.
But I'm pretty sure there's been in the past a few selections that weren't actually made by a woman or were sort of about a man, but how it related to a woman.
Yeah.
So, and there's also anyone can create a film and put their film in, and we're going to have flyers out at the event of how to do that. So that's really exciting. I don't think we've had anyone from Juno yet submit an entry, but I think
we have quite an active filmmaking organization wandering through the town, primarily growing out of UAS's film production classes and then expanding from that. So it's certainly conceivable.
Yes, I would love to see that happen. I'm dreaming for that to happen. One of LunaFest's mission is to celebrate and inspire women through the art of film and community fundraising. So they're very much behind filmmakers, too.
So what does it cost? What is the donation that will go off to breast cancer and the organization?
The tickets are $10 in advance, which you can buy them at Heartside or from a board member, or you can go to the LunaFest website, which is lunafest.org, and just put in our zip code, and you'll be able to buy them there. Or if you buy them at the door, they'll be $12. Also, let everyone know there will be a silent auction that starts at 6, where we have art that you can bid on and some lace panties and some other really fun stuff. There will be an intermission where we'll do the final bidding, and we also have door prizes. I know there's a great lemon cake coming, chocolate chip cookies. We're going to have the roller derby girls helping to pass out things. Excuse me if that should be roller derby women.
Actually, they call that's the name of the team.
Is it girls?
Yeah, it's girls.
I sort of thought so, but I did. I know they're women, so.
Yes, they are. That's quite a growing organization. We're going to have to get them on the show and interview some of them.
Yeah, that looks fun.
Yeah. Yes. Time again?
So the time again is silent auction at 6, and the films start at 6:30. This is a half hour earlier than we've done it other years, so make sure you come on time, and it's a great opportunity to support pro-choice motion in Juno and also Breast Cancer Fund.
And Centennial Hall.
Centennial Hall.
Tickets available at Hearthside and from board members.
And at the door.
And at the door, they're $12. So it's $10 in advance and $12 at the door, right?
Yes.
Well, good. I wish you great success with the showing, and it'll be interesting to see whether some of these films go on to the larger film showings, independent film showings.
Right. And thank you. And I'd really like to add, too, men are definitely welcome at this event, and they're always there, and I've had them sitting next to me laughing as hard as everyone else. So
well, thank you very
everyone,
much.
Please come. We're excited to see you.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Wacky collides with wonderful. A fusion of feathers and fabrics, duct tape and diamonds explode in the 12th annual Wearable Arts Extravaganza, Saturday, February 11th at 8 p.m. and Sunday, February 12th at 3 p.m. at Centennial Hall. Doors open 1 hour prior to the show for the fabulous silent auction. Pre-bidding begins online January 21st. Get your tickets today at the Jack, Hearthside Books Valley in downtown, or online at jahc.org. Sponsored by Bauer Clifton Interiors and Northwind Architects.
Is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 17th of January, 2012. It's the birthday of Benjamin Franklin, born Boston, 1706. Only had 2 years of formal schooling, but he read a lot and read early on the essays of Joseph Addison and Richard Steele. And he said in his autobiography, "Writing well became of great use to me in the course of my life and was a principal means of my advancement." He wrote under the pen name Richard Saunders, Poor Richard's Almanac. It came out for 26 years, weather predictions, household hints, poetry, essays, and adages, such as "Married in haste, we often repent at leisure," and "Where there's marriage without love, there will be love without marriage." It was on this date, 1773, Captain James Cook and his crew on the HMS Resolution became the first Europeans to sail below the Antarctic Circle. He was sailing uncharted areas of the Pacific, making maps as he went. He'd sailed around New Zealand. He'd charted the eastern shore of Australia, decided to sail around the bottom of the world. Ship had some trouble with pack ice, but sailed within about 150 miles of Antarctica before they had to turn back. 1904, on this date, Chekhov's play The Cherry Orchard had its premiere at the Moscow Art Theater. His play The Seagull had been a big hit there, whose founder, Konstantin Stanislavsky, wanted naturalistic plays rather than popular melodramas. The Cherry Orchard was Chekhov's last play, a story of an aristocratic matriarch and her family who come home from Paris to find that their family estate is about to be sold to pay their debts, and they're horrified at the idea of losing their beloved cherry orchard, the site of so many happy childhood memories. But they do nothing to save it, and the estate is sold to the son of a former servant. The play ends with the sound of the orchard being cut down. Chekhov wrote the play as a comedy, but Stanislavsky presented it as a tragedy, and Chekhov was upset with him for ruining his play. Chekhov had his characters speaking through tears. He wrote to Stanislavsky, "In the second act, there are tears in their eyes, but the tone is happy, lively. Why did you put so many tears in my play? Where are they?" Cherry Orchard was a big success with audiences, and ever since, directors have been challenged by the play's delicate balance of tragedy and farce. Here's a poem for today by Dana Gioia, New Year's. "Let other mornings honor the miraculous. Eternity has festivals enough. This is the feast of our mortality, the most mundane and human holiday. On other days, we misinterpret time, pretending that we live the present moment. But can this blur, this smudgy in-between, this tiny fissure where the future drips into the past, this fly speck we call now, be our true habitat? The present is the leaky palm of water that we skim from the swift, silent river slipping by. The new year always brings us what we want, simply by bringing us along to see a calendar with every day uncrossed, a field of snow without a single footprint. New Year's, a poem by Dana Gioia from Interrogations at Noon, published by Grey Wolf Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by Constant Contact, helping small businesses use email marketing with social media to reach more customers in more places. Online at constantcontact.com. Produced by our technical director, Thomas Schweitzer. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 5 minutes to four. You're in tune with KTOO News. This is Pat Moore, host for Juno Afternoon. My guest at the moment is Catherine Milliron, who's been principal of most of the schools in Juno, I think, off and on, at least one crack. And she's going to talk to us about the upcoming choice nights, which are tomorrow night and the next night for eighth graders to decide which of our high schools they want to go to. Did I do it right?
Yes, you did that. You did that very well. Hey. In fact, families of our incoming freshmen, any family can attend these evenings. They're from 6 to 8 p.m. at both TMHS and Juno Douglas High School. The goal is to deliver information to those families about the freshman experience and the individual high schools. As we know, most families make their choices for high schools based on demographics. That's about 70%. Other families who are on the fence with choosing a high school or need more information, they can go to one night or both nights. There will be representation from administrators at each high school at the other high school.
Now, you cured part of my ignorance before the program started, because I said to you as we were warming up for the interview that there was a big difference between the two high schools, and you were telling me that those differences have kind of been ameliorated now.
Yes. Last year, a group of secondary principals, administrators, the district-level administrators, Karen Smolin, who's our CTE coordinator at the district level, and some teachers all got together and worked on specific pathways and endorsements. So JDHS may have pathways and endorsements that cover the ACE, architecture, auto, construction and engineering, athletics, recreation and medicine, business and communication and humanities, while Thunder Mountain High School has an exploration and discovery learning community with pathways and endorsements in healthcare, marine and environmental sciences, science, technology, engineering, and math, which is the STEM pathway and endorsement, business and hospitality pathway, which is culinary arts and entrepreneurship, fine arts pathway, which is digital communications endorsement, performance arts, visual arts, and we're just now beginning our leadership, law, and humanities service pathway and endorsement.
Each of these pathways, then, would be a different experience for a student going through high school.
Well, what we've determined is that any student entering high school should be able to earn at least one endorsement prior to them exiting with a diploma. But more than likely, because of the way the endorsements and pathways are set up and individual choice, students could earn 2 to 3 endorsements by taking a smorgasbord of classes throughout their pathways. Students can change pathways at any time during their high school careers, and both high schools have the honors endorsement and the AP.
Catherine, that was quite a laundry list. If people are coming to the two sessions tomorrow night or Thursday night, is there some place they can look at that before they arrive at that, like an online site or something along that line?
That is very good. You can go to the Juno School District.
That's a very complex website. Can you give us a little more where to point the mouse?
Yes. I'm going to tell you where to point the mouse just as soon as I find it. It's on this, my cheat sheet here. You can go to the Juno School, and I had it earlier. the Juno School District, jsd.k12.ak.us.
Okay.
Or junoschooldistrict.org.
Okay.
And you can find that. I'd like to, while we're talking about that, point to another website that's very important, because families are going to be very interested in the Alaska Performance Scholarship. We're going to have some information about that at our family nights tomorrow and Thursday from 6 to 8 at both high schools. But the capital APS.alaska.gov will give you a fact sheet concerning the Alaska Performance Scholarship, and it's important. It's, like you said, a laundry list. It's too much to go over in such a short period of time, but it's important that all families are aware of that.
So the time for these two sessions for choice tomorrow and Thursday are?
They're going to be at each high school, each main high school, in their commons or library. Once you enter, they'll direct you, or auditorium. They're from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. There will be administrative representation from each high school at the alternate high school to go over and answer questions. You don't have to feel necessarily obligated to attend both nights. You're welcome to attend both nights at either high school, but you can get just about all the information you need by attending one.
What's the date by which the choice has to be made?
The choice cards with all of our incoming eighth graders are due to their principal's office or administrative offices at their middle school by February 1st.
So at the middle schools by February 1, that's the date at which they have to make this selection as to which school they're going to go to.
That is correct.
Perfect. Thank you. Catherine Milhorn.
Milliron. Ms. Milhorn is the manager at the swimming pool.
Catherine Milliron.
Okay, it's very close.
Thank you so much for coming down and telling us about this really important decision that's coming up for most of us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Tomorrow on Juno Afternoon, we'll be hearing about the Juno Symphony performance coming up with Kyle Pickett and Dr. Noyes. Grady Saunders and Marie Gregovich will be here from Heritage Coffee. We'll hear about Big Brothers Big Sisters School Mentoring Program. And the Rental and Repair Shop at Eagle Crest will send Mike Cole down to us to talk about the opportunities up there. You're listening to KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in Jonestown, Juno, and Douglas, and we broadcast on translators in the Valley in Auk Bay. We're on K276 AF at 103.1 in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek. It's K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus is on K21 AM at 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9 and Excursion Inlet Nicey Strait. We're on K210 AS at 89.9.
You don't understand. It's dark here. Can't see anything. The commander spits out, "What is it? You want to go home, Schettino? It's dark and you want to go home?" In Italy, abandoning ship carries a 12-year prison term. Silvio Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
The Republican candidates for president are campaigning all over South Carolina today. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, Newt Gingrich made comments about Islam at a town hall-style event in West Columbia.
The former House Speaker was asked by a man in the audience whether he would support a Muslim American running for president.
I think it would depend entirely on whether they would commit in public to give...